All right, and so tonight we have the three new people. We go through the book, and we start in September 2008. So this September will be our 11th year, finish our 11th year. And we started the big book over, I think, for the 11th time on Sunday night, and we're on Doctor's Opinion. And we spent some time on the cover, and if you look at the site, experiencethebigbook.org, if you look at wherever I started the big book over, I've done different things. This time we didn't do on the how the big book was put together, what were the books used, but that's, I've done podcasts on that. The Oxford Group, which is where we took the steps from, and our program, I did a whole thing on them too. We're on Doctor's Opinion, which I find most people who come here from treatment have never read. I don't know if that's good or bad, but the Doctor's Opinion was written in 1938, probably the end of 38, because the book was published in April of 39, and he was Dr. Silkworth, who didn't sign the first time he did it, because his views on alcoholism were not accepted by the medical fraternity. In fact, the medical fraternity had no idea what was wrong with us, except that we needed help, and they couldn't help us. And we were baffling to them, our behavior and our thinking. And he wrote the Doctor's Opinion, which was actually page one of the original book. In 1955, when alcoholics got together to do the second edition, these alcoholics who put the second edition together decided that there couldn't be a page number for Doctor's Opinion, so they made it Roman numerals for some crazy. The reason I've heard is that they thought only alcoholics could have page numbers and the non-alcoholics would have Roman numerals. Does it sound like alcoholism? Sounds like a GSR meeting. Anyway, so that's why. Oh, excuse me. Our GSR objected to that. The Doctor's Opinion is now an appendix, and I don't know if that's helped or hurt whether people read it or not, but it's how the big book starts. And we read last week how he said there's how they wrote that we think it's important that we understand that there's something wrong with our body. So they say the doctor's theory that we have an allergy interests us, and then he started his letter on XXVII. Now, having been a physician, he submitted this letter to the New England Journal of Medicine, which is the most prestigious journal of medicine. It's published out of Boston. And this was accepted, and then this got published, and this changed the way the medical field started to look at alcoholics. And then in the second edition, Dr. Silkworth signed this, because it was accepted, and then remember they made it a disease, and then they gave us a DSM code, and once they did that, then they could start treatment because then insurance companies could pay for it. And that's how the treatment centers got started in the late 60s, early 70s. And I think that's, I don't have an opinion whether it's good or bad, but that's what happened. And we became a disease in 1955, I think. And then it's accepted what we're gonna read tonight. And then we just read that first page, XXVII, last week. And now we're going to find out what's wrong with me. At least it's what's wrong with me. If you're new, you see if this is what's wrong with you. And Dr. Silkworth worked at the Towns Hospital in New York for Charles Towns, who had a hospital for alcoholism and addiction. And all he did all day long was take care of alcoholics and addicts. Can you imagine? What a job. And remember, there was no big book. There was no 12 steps. There was nothing. And he was a brilliant man because he could see what was wrong with the alcoholics. So the problem of what's wrong with me came from a neurologist psychiatrist. And the solution came from Dr. Carl Jung, which we're going to read about, in Switzerland, who was a psychiatrist. And the steps came from the Oxford Group, which was a Christian group of Christian people trying to live a fundamental Christian life as practiced by the disciples after Jesus came. Think about that. So none of this came from alcoholics. And the whole book was put together from information. None of it was originated in Bill W.'s mind. But God chose him and a few others to put this stuff together, so we have it today. If we didn't have this book, I wouldn't have been able to work the steps. There's no other way to work the steps, I believe, other than the directions in the book. Now, you can work them differently, but you won't have what they had. You'll have your program and your steps, and I don't know if that'll work for you. I do know that if we follow this path and we do these directions, it's worked for me. Does it work for anybody else in the room? Yes. And so if you want the cake that they made, you use their recipe. I don't bake much. I don't bake ever. But I did look at a Pillsbury cake box, and on the back, on the side is specific directions. Now, of course, alcoholics never read directions, right? So they never get that cake. When they cook a cake, they get their cake. But if we follow these directions, we're going to get what they had. Do you want what these people had? Because this is a testimony. So let's look. I've babbled enough. Let's look at, see what he says on XXVIII. Damn, I wish you had numbers. At this meeting, we've done a lot of things through the years. We bought this book. I still have one. We all bought it. This was about our second or third year, where you could take notes in the side. It's a really good book. The problem is, it's the original book. So it starts with page one, Doctor's Opinion. So if you're using that book and people don't have the book and they got the other book, then it gets really confusing. So anyway, all right, let's get that. Let's get back into this. I'm sorry. I'm in a good mood. Last Game of Thrones tonight. And so we'll see. He believes, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. Now, I think it's important to look chronic alcoholic, because people will tell me, well, they didn't always have this allergy to alcohol. But over time, we all get it. So I don't know. I had it from the moment I first drank. And others have too, but I guess it can be acquired. But when you become a chronic alcoholic, the effect of alcohol is an allergy. So somebody said, well, how can I be allergic to something that I can drink gobs of? Well, an allergy is just an abnormal reaction to something. Anybody have allergies to penicillin?
Yes.
All right. Anybody have allergies to peanuts? Those are serious. You can die. People who have allergies don't usually want more of what they're allergic to. I never had a patient come in and say, I'm allergic to penicillin, doctor. Can I have 10? It just doesn't happen. But we have an allergy to alcohol, and let's see what it means. And then we kept wanting more of what we're allergic to. It says it's a phenomenon of craving. So craving is the allergy that we have. Now, you'll hear new people say that they're sober. They crave a drink. You can't crave a drink sober. You crave the second drink when you have it in your body. And what happens is, when you put alcohol in your body, you want a second drink. Did anybody ever have that? In fact, most alcoholics, when they decide to drink, they don't buy like a little 3-ounce bottle or something. I've never heard anybody drinking, relapsing on a half a beer. You know, they don't go and buy, we buy enough, right? Anybody else do that? Anybody else, when you drank, wanted to make sure you had enough alcohol? No. Anybody hide alcohol?
Yes.
All right, now, that should be the question that makes you an alcoholic, because normal people don't hide legal substances, right? But I think everybody in this room has hidden alcohol from somebody, and we think we're very clever. I'll tell you how I know I'm an alcoholic, because when I came back from my treatment, I had to carry at least 100 bottles, big bottles of Kahlua that I had under the steps. I can't tell you how many trips. I filled the whole trash can. And while I was doing that, I said, you know, normal people don't have this. I mean, maybe they didn't like Kahlua, but they don't have 100 bottles of it under their stairs. But that's a sobering thing to remember, isn't it? So anyway, the phenomenon of craving never occurs in normal people. Now, I just took a 16-day cruise where all the booze was included, and people would actually taste the wine to see if it's any good, swirl it around, try it, and then they'd drink half a glass. And then they get a different type, because they had to have the white and the red. I don't know what that's all about. And you know, they're not like us. And I still remember years ago, they asked me why I wouldn't have a little toast. You know, a little toast. I said, well, I can drink this, but I don't know if there's enough booze on the ship. And they looked at me really, really funny. And they thought I was joking. I said, well, I could drink this, and I might be okay tonight, but I could end up under a bridge in 6 months and lose everything. And so I didn't go into more detail. I don't have to explain myself to other people, but I just said, no, I don't think I'm going to do it. And then I remember when I was 13 at Seder, we had Manischewitz wine. It's pretty good. It's good. It's good. Debbie liked it. It's good stuff. It's cheap and it's sweet. Said I had the Seder, and then I went downstairs to watch TV, and I kept going upstairs to get a little bit more. And I didn't even know that I had the craving. I just went up and said, that's good, and I'm gonna have some more. And then I had some more, and I think I got a little happy there and a little drunk at 13. But it was already true for me. I didn't drink because I was a good Jewish boy in Baltimore, and I went to Duke and I was still 17. And I remember we went and had beer with the babes. You know, they have the freshman guys and girls get together. It's before school starts. Went to this place and we had a pitcher of beer. And I drank my first beer and I said, this is terrible. It is.
This Give
is.
Me some more.
And then I had a second one, and I had a third one.
Yeah.
And then I thought it was so terrible that I couldn't wait for the keg party on Saturday. And that was the first time that I encountered the bathroom. Get it? The porcelain bowl? All right. Well, people are listening. I'm getting off here. But if you have to understand what you have to know what to do about it. So I can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Does anybody believe that?
Yes.
Everybody believes it.
Yes.
So why did anybody who believed that ever go and take another drink again? See, we're going to get to that. We know we can't put it in our body. Does everybody understand that?
Yes.
And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, they lose their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them, and become astonishingly difficult to solve. So you form the habit and you find you can't break it. So you have the habit of drinking, you can't break it, and you have this allergy that causes you to crave more. Anybody lose their self-confidence?
Yes.
Relies upon human things, human. He's very nice. He's saying things turned to crap. Things were bad. Anybody have problems when they come up in here? Anybody have a lot of them? And they were difficult to solve, but we still tried to solve them, didn't we? You know, we still had a plan. So here's, and then he's describing powerless over alcohol. Now this page is so important because now we've looked at we're powerless over alcohol, and we're going to look at why and what the solution is, just in six paragraphs. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. So people could tell you need to quit drinking. People could tell you were insane, right? People could tell you things about your behavior, but it never worked. But there is a message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people. It must have depth and weight. Well, that's what the big book is. The big book is a message to you if you suffer from what they had of depth and weight. And it's a testimony. It offers a solution. That's why we study it. It's not because I worship the book, but I worship the treasure that the book gives me, which is God. This is just a treasure map to God. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they're going to recreate their life. So your life when you came in here was you lost self-confidence, you lost reliance upon things human, your problems pile up on them and become difficult to solve. So you want to recreate your life. Does anybody think that's important? Anybody came in here, did people want to change? People want something different? And so we want to recreate our lives, which I wrote is change my character. And then I wrote my ideals where my old ideas must be grounded in new ideas. I had old ideas when I came in here. Anybody else have them? I still have them. Yeah. There are things I know are true that are wrong. And I decided they were true, and I believed myself, but they were wrong. And your fourth step is where you look at all your old ideas, and you see what you were wrong about. Anybody have anger when you come in here? That's wrong judgment. Anybody have fear? That's wrong belief. Anybody harm anybody? Bad actions. You see how it works? My ideals, my new ideas must be grounded in somebody besides me, besides my thinking. There's so much in that statement, isn't there? If you're going to recreate your life. So as I'm telling you what the solution is, you have to have your ideals grounded in something besides you. And you have to have new ideals. And you need to recreate your life. Then he talks about how hopeless we are. If anybody feels that a psychiatrist directing a hospital, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line, see the tragedies of the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even their sleeping moments. Have you worked with a lot of people? Have you tried to help a lot of alcoholics? You've been on the firing line. You know what it's like. If you tried to sponsor and help a lot of people, you know how hard it is for people to get this. And the most cynical, and look what he says, will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. Now he wrote this in like 1938, and when did Bill and Bob meet? 1935. And there was just three groups at this time, one in Cleveland, one in New York and Akron, and there were about 80 people sober, maybe 100 if you're optimistic. But he had seen cases, because he wrote, and he's going to tell you that later, he had seen changes in people that he couldn't explain, and he had no power to do on his own. So he was had a very strong feeling for the information in this book. All right, now here's the key. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. So I ask a lot of people what's wrong with them. They come in, and then they usually have a lot of different answers. But first I have to have them understand what's wrong with their body. Now we just went through that, right? There's something wrong with my body that when I put alcohol in it, I can't control how much I drink. And everybody here has that?
Yes.
All right, so the answer to that is to not drink. Just say no. Remember that? You're probably not old enough, but that was a big thing. Just say no. Nancy Reagan. Just say no. And it made a lot of sense, didn't it? Well, if you can say no, then you're just a hard drinker. Because we're going to read in the book that it says there are people who are hard drinkers who are given a sufficient reason to quit, they can do so. Now, they may have damaged their liver and they may have withdrawal, but they can quit. Now, if you're not a hard drinker and you're a real alcoholic, you cannot quit drinking on your own, ever. Anybody agree with that?
Yes.
You've lost the power of choice, so we're going to look at that now. They drink because they like the effect. So they'll tell me that they do have a problem with control. So I say, well, why don't you just not drink? Well, why did you take the first drink? Then there's a bunch of reasons. We take the first drink because sober, we don't like how we feel. Anybody else have that? And we're going to have a whole chapter on that and more about alcoholism. Now, if I had a great day, would that keep you from drinking? No. Was getting everything you wanted enough to keep you from drinking? No. If you had a bad day, could you keep from drinking? You're never going to have your life and your feelings at the point where you won't drink again. Does anybody agree with that?
Yes.
You have no defense against the first drink. Now, when we first drank, did anybody think it was great? It changed the way you felt. Has anybody heard the promises at the meeting? Those promises are really what alcohol gave you. When, have you ever read it that way? Page 83. When I drank, I knew a new freedom and a new happiness.
Yes.
When I drank alcohol, I didn't regret the past. When I drank alcohol, I comprehended the word serenity. I knew everything. And peace. Anybody have that?
Yes.
No matter how bad things were, I knew my experience could benefit others when I was drunk. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity disappeared when I drank. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Almost immediately. What a great stuff. We will lose interest in selfish things when I drank. I don't know if that's true. But I gained interest in my fellows. Of course, I loved everybody, right? Self-seeking slipped away. It just slipped away when I drank. My whole attitude and outlook of my life changed when I drank. Remember Bill W., the stock market dies, drops, everybody's jumping out of buildings. He says, well, I'm going to go to the bar. And it's going to work out. I intuitively knew how to handle every situation when I was drinking. I had no fear of anything. And I suddenly realized that alcohol could do for me what I could not do for myself. Now, it sounds funny and all, but it's true. So if alcohol had this power to change how I felt, why are you surprised that it had some power in your brain that you knew when you didn't feel well that alcohol could do all this? You see what happened? So we start drinking for the effect, but we have the allergy of the body, so we can't control. And then we want to stop it. Our mind remembers what alcohol did for me. And I seek the effect of alcohol. Why? He's going to tell us. The sensation, the effect is so elusive. While they admit it's injurious, they cannot after time differentiate the true from the false. Their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Well, it seems normal that when you don't feel good and things are bothering you, you want to drink. You want to change the way you feel, doesn't it? And you know it's injurious, but it's the way you lived. Whether you're an alcoholic or an addict, it doesn't matter. If you're drinking, if you're taking something because of the effect produced by it, your mind's going to want it. And it seems normal, right? You're drinking a whole bottle of Kahlua every night. You think that's normal. Other people might say, and then, of course, you can't even throw it away, right? You have to throw it under the thing. You understand how abnormal our life was and how injurious it was, and we couldn't see the truth. Anybody else have that? Now, here's the key line. I was a restless, irritable, and discontented human being. Now, I was irritable, restless, and discontented before I ever drank. Now, what does that mean? It means that I couldn't feel okay just being Michael at 5 years old. Something was missing. I needed something that I didn't have it with me. I wanted approval, I wanted to be loved, I wanted to be recognized. Anybody else have that? I had that when I was 5. I had to figure out what I needed to get out of life to be okay. And I decided I would get good grades, or I would do this or that. And so we start this living our lives trying to fix how we feel with things or dependence on other people. Anybody do that? We didn't even know I didn't know I was doing it. And I was always restless. I never felt quite okay. Irritable means that we got pissed off a lot. Anybody get pissed off? Restless, can't sit still. You're not happy with things. Discontented. These are the feelings we had. And it's the result of living the life on self-centeredness. We lived a life of selfishness. We lived a life where we needed approval. We were dependent on other people, right? Things. We blocked out God by worship of other things, right?
Yes.
We were trying to get things out there fixed so it would be okay in here. Anybody do that? Now, AA says, screw out there, you need to fix it here. And if you fix in here, it doesn't matter what's going on out there, you can be okay. Is that the greatest promise? And it's true. So we don't feel good, and this is sober. Now, a lot of people read and they think this is after you drink. Well, after you drink, a lot of bad things happen. But before you drink, you have these feelings, and you drink to treat your feelings. Alcoholism is a disease of perception. It has nothing to do with alcohol. Alcohol was just the thing that changed the perception of the world that I didn't like. And the world was always gray. Anybody ever see The Wizard of Oz? It's gray. Then suddenly I wake up and it's all in color. And that's what alcohol or drugs did for me. It changed the way I saw the world. Now here's what we say in AA. You have these, your alcoholic glasses on, the world's gray. Work the steps and the world becomes color. And step 10 is how all day long, when you start seeing the world in gray, you change your, put a new pair of glasses on. So the glasses I wore, the way I saw the world being, living on what Michael wanted, the world was always gray. It was never good enough. And so I sought the ease and comfort of alcohol. And they're addicts and alcoholics. We cleared that up last week, didn't we? Because it says on XXVII, those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. Now, when I first came in, if people said they were addict, the alcoholics would look down on them, you know, like, ooh, you know? And we had some pure alcoholics in those days. I don't know if we have any anymore. But you're addicted to whatever changes the way you feel. And you seek the ease and comfort of whatever it is that changes the way you feel, and you'll become addicted to it. Now, I'm lucky, my pill for my heart arrhythmia, I'm not addicted to it. So it doesn't change how I feel, so I don't take extra. You get it? But if it's something changes the way I feel, I'm gonna get addicted to it. There's nothing safe for me. I know that. And so it gives me a sense of needs of comfort, which comes by taking a few drinks, or you could say drugs. Drinks which they see others take with impunity. So if I succumb to the desire to change the way I feel by taking a substance, either alcohol or drug, and I succumb to that, then I get the craving. And I keep drinking. People who are addicts, well, their craving is that one pill's never enough, and 1,000's too many, remember? And so if you were an addict and you wouldn't just take one pill, it wouldn't get you where you wanted to be, right? So you'd have to get enough. Well, it's the same for us. Our craving's different because our body just craves more. We can't control it. And an addict can't control it either. They can't say, I'm just going to take one pill tonight. The phenomenon of craving develops. They go through the spree. They emerge remorseful. Anybody do that? A firm resolution not to drink again. It's firm. Anybody believe it when they said it? Anybody have a plan to quit? I always had a plan. I had a plan. I'm going to do it this weekend. Or I'm going to do it this week. And I had it. It was all, and it was great because I could tell myself about it and feel really good because I was going to quit on that weekend. And then that never happened. I couldn't follow through. Now, when you take a firm resolution to drink, why can't that work? When we do it, we could pass a lie detector test, right? Why won't it work? Because our mind's damaged regarding alcohol. Our mind knows that these promises will come true if we drink it. We don't feel, we don't like the way we feel, and our mind seeks it. And when our mind seeks alcohol, nothing can overcome that. Does anybody believe that? Nothing can overcome it, ever. And then I succumb to the desire, and then I have the craving, and I'm screwed. And it's pretty sobering. I guess that's a word to use. It's very sobering to think about this. That we have a bad situation, but we're here tonight, a lot of us with many years of sobriety, and a lot of people have happy lives now. Why? Because now, when I don't like the way I feel, I work the steps and I seek God. And I know that alcohol is a bad idea. Now, I know it's a bad idea today because it comes from God. And when I think of alcohol, I don't think about what it's going to do for me anymore. I only think about what it's going to do to me. And it can't do anything for me anymore that'll make me feel better than I already am if I work the steps. It doesn't mean that you don't have bad days and you don't have negative feelings. But when I react with negative feelings now, I seek God to change the way I see things. So the solution for me is not alcohol anymore, it's God. And he says it, experience an entire psychic change. There's very little hope of recovery. And without it, the cycle goes on and on. Now the psychic change is to change your personality. Your personality from what? Self-centered to God-centered. Centered on me to centered on how I can serve God and others. Now that's a pretty drastic change for an alcoholic. In fact, none of us even knew that that's what's our problem. When we came in, it was always them, right? And it was never us. And then when we start working the steps, it was always us, and it was never them. Son of a gun. And so the entire psychic change means you're going to change your whole attitude and outlook on life. You're going to change the way you see things. Now, I don't have the power to have the psychic change. I need something else to do it for me. And the steps are how you do it. And then I'll end with this next paragraph. On the other hand, strange as it may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired over solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. The only effort being to follow a few simple rules. Now they left this out. It's not their rules. It's the rules that other people have put down to follow. You get it? And they're basically God's rules. Now I'll go to one other thing to tie this all together. On page 44, you finally get to page 44 in the big book, and they've told you on 43 that you have no defense against drinking, right? And then on page 44, it says they make clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. You see it, top of the page? It's one of the most important paragraphs in the book. If when you honestly want to, you cannot quit entirely. Anybody have that problem? Or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you're an alcoholic. Now here's the key line that you almost never hear at meeting. If that's the case, and you're a real alcoholic, you have an illness from which only a spiritual experience can conquer it. It's not 90 meetings in 90 days. It's not thinking through the drink. It's not meeting makers make it. It's not, you know, take what you want, leave the rest, do a step a year. You need a spiritual experience to conquer it. Now, I'm not being silly. This is sobering words. This is powerful stuff. The psychic change comes from your spiritual experience with God. And your spiritual experience, when you'd work the steps, is equivalent to what alcohol did for you. And you replace that with what God can do for you. Anybody heard God can, we suddenly realize God is doing for me what I cannot do for myself. And so now, instead of seeking alcohol, I go to God. Because God won't give me the phenomenon of craving, right? God will give me peace and serenity no matter what's going on. Now, you're probably going to throw me out. I'm going to read one more thing. Because it's so important. On page 100. It actually starts at the bottom of 99. It says, no, is it okay if I read this?
Yeah.
Let no alcoholic say he cannot recover unless he has his family back. This just isn't so. In some cases, the wife will never come back. Remind the prospect, that's the alcoholic, that my recovery is not dependent upon people. It's dependent upon my relationship with God. Now, the people you meet in AA, it's good to be with them seeking God together. It's good to be dependent on someone who's taking you down the path to God, but not on the person themselves, you see. And it's dependent upon your relationship with God. Now, I couldn't have survived without AA and the people I met, taking me to the book taking me to God with other people. But I have to put, everything depends on my relationship with God. Now, here's the key. Both me and the new man, we're all new, really, every day. We must walk day by day, and I say hand in hand in the path of spiritual progress. Why? Because alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it's too much for us, remember? And we have to keep walking down the path of spiritual progress because alcohol is always waiting there to change the way I feel. And the spiritual progress is seeking the power that will change the way I feel. If I persist, remarkable things will happen. Now, I love this line. If ever I'm full of self-pity or getting a little you-know-what, I just think of this line. It says, when I look back to February 8th, 2002, I realized the things which came to me when I put myself in God's hands were better than anything I could have planned. And so I know that. So if I have anything going on, I could put myself in God's hands. Now here's the key. This is the most powerful line in the big book, probably ever written, till I do next week's meeting. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently, now is the presently, live in a new and wonderful world. Now, I tried to change the new and wonderful world by following the dictates of Michael. Anybody else do that? And here's the key. No matter what my present circumstances, the world can always be new and wonderful. You can have a child die like I did, and you can get through it with God. No matter what happens out there, you can be okay in here. Doesn't mean you don't get sad or you don't suffer from loss, but you can be okay with the world if you follow the dictates of God, because that's the psychic change, that's the spiritual experience that conquers the disease. I hope I've tied it together. So this is powerful stuff. I talked too long, but don't tell Ed, okay? Thank you.